Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week, I'm happy to say that we have Amar Valerio Jimenez on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. This is a much-anticipated book, I can tell you that. I used to teach with Amar, and I enjoyed hearing him talk about it while it was in production, and I'm so happy to see it in my hands. I've read it. It's terrific. I hope everybody goes out and buys it. So the first thing I want to say is, Amar, thank you very much for writing the book.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
Absolutely. And welcome to the show. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm originally from the South Texas border region where this book takes place. That's part of the reason I wrote the book, and we'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. I was born in Mexico. My dad is an American citizen. My mom's a Mexican citizen. I lived in Mexico for the first 6 years of my life. And then we moved to Texas. And so I grew up in the South Texas region. In several cities are in the South Texas region. But the whole time I was growing up, I had relatives in Mexico since my mom was from there and my dad had relatives in Mexico. So we would go back and forth a lot. And one of the things I realized when I was growing up is that even though, you know, the South Texas border region where I grew up is predominantly Mexican-American, not all Mexican-Americans have the kind of relationship with the border as I do or as my family did. Many of them do not cross the border very often, and obviously this has changed now because of all the drug violence and so forth, that there are fewer people cross on a weekly basis or a monthly basis. But when I was growing up, people would cross a lot, and so I did, but not everyone did. And so I started noticing that there were these differences between, say, recent Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans who had lived in Texas for a long time and who were, you know, ninth generation or, you know, second generation or third generation or what have you. And so I grew up there, went to high school there, and then went to college in Massachusetts. And that was one of the reasons that I started thinking about the place where I grew up also, because when I went off to college, college is a learning experience and it really opens your eyes to a lot of things, especially if you're going, to such a different kind of cultural and geographical environment as, South Texas to Massachusetts, to Cambridge. One of the things that I realized was that, when I was growing up in South Texas, even though we think of Mexican Americans in the U.S. as being an ethnic minority population. In South Texas, they're the majority population. There's the counties where I grew up that are 80% Mexican American, mm-hmm. or some of them are 95% Mexican American. Mm-hmm. So when I grew up, it wasn't unusual for me to see judges, to see doctors, lawyers, principals. Everyone was Mexican American, fire chiefs, police officers. So that wasn't unusual. But when I left, when I went to Massachusetts, all of a sudden I could see that I was an ethnic minority. Mm-hmm. And not only in, numerical numbers, but also just in the way people sort of interacted with you and so forth. And so that was, that got me thinking about, the place where I grew up. And then I started, I was an engineering major as an undergrad, actually, I started as an engineering major and then became interested in history and politics and so forth and in the humanities. I went to school at MIT, and we have to take one undergraduate, as undergraduates, we have to take one humanities course a semester. And they call everything that's not engineering or basically STEM humanities.
Yeah.
So I was lucky, and I took a class with a great professor, Marjorie Resnick, in Spanish literature, and mainly because we all get first year advisors, and my roommate at the time was also Mexican American from Fort Worth, and Marjorie Resnick was his freshman advisor, and she wanted to have some native Spanish speakers in her class, in her literature class, Spanish mm-hmm. literature. So there was about 15 students, and I'll make this brief, but it's a sort of a defining moment in my life. And half of the students were from Latin America, you know, undergraduates from Chile, Argentina, so forth, and then half were from the U.S. And the students from Latin America had a very sharp critique of U.S. Diplomacy and U.S. policies. And it was the first time I'd heard that kind of critique because I grew up in a conservative, politically conservative environment in South Texas. Even though I went to public schools, you didn't hear that critique. And so I was really sort of shocked. And eventually at the end of the class, I asked the professor like if she could recommend another class for me. And she did. And she recommended a class called Intellectuals and Social Change that was co-taught by an English professor, Louis Kampf, and a linguistics professor that I had never heard of. But his name's Noam Chomsky. And that class basically sort of changed my life.
I was going to say, you were probably the first person to come to a class with Noam Chomsky without any sorts of preconceptions.
Yeah, I had no idea. And once I was in the class, I thought, oh my God, you know, like I learned more about him. And that class actually was really different because there was about 25 students in the class, and there was a lot of graduate students, you know, international graduate students. Mm-hmm. And I had never been in a class with international graduate students. But anyway, and after that, I had realized, like, I'm not going to be an engineer for the rest of my life. And I ended up double majoring. I did a degree in humanities. They called it humanities. And I met, you know, anthropologists and political scientists and so forth. And so I started realizing, like, okay, there's a lot of things I don't know. And there's a lot of things I don't know about actually the region where I grew up. Because I wrote some research papers for classes, for history classes or political science classes on South Texas. Then I realized, like, this history that I'm actually learning about in Massachusetts, I never knew when I was in South Texas. Why didn't I know that? So that was that got me thinking about the role of history, the role of education, public education, really. And it got me very interested in pursuing sort of a career outside of engineering. I graduated, I went to work, I worked for 5 years as an engineer, as an electrical engineer back in Texas, and I basically did volunteer work after school, and I took some engineering classes just to make sure, do I really want to leave this? And I took a sociology class, I took a history class, and at the time, you know, a very defining book came out by David Montejano, Anglos and Mexicans in the Making of Texas. And that book basically also sort of made me realize, okay, this is really what I want to do. And so I applied to grad school, went to UCLA, went to work at George Sanchez, and decided I'm going to write history about that history that I learned about at MIT and, at Cambridge, that should have been taught in public schools, and it wasn't. And so I'm going to learn about that. And that's somewhat of the origins of the book.
So it's sort of a voyage of self-discovery in a way.
It was definitely. And, you know, people say that books are always written about, you know, something, the author has some sort of, interest, and there's some sort of link, you know, not always as much of a self-discovery as mine, but usually there's some sort of link. Mm-hmm. And in my case, there was definitely a very strong link. So I wrote the book. I worked in California for a while. I had my first job was at Cal State Long Beach, and then moved to University of Iowa. Mm-hmm. That's where I met you. Mm-hmm. And now I'm an associate professor there at in the history department. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to, you know, writing the second book.
Yeah, the second book. Boy, that second book. But, you know, one thing I found fascinating about this particular the topic is how multi-layered the history is. I mean, I come from a place that is, I won't call it homogenous, but pretty much the white people came and killed the Indians, and that was more or less it. And then the black people came, and that's the story. I'm sure somebody who's from Kansas will say, no, that's totally wrong. But it's not terribly multi-layered. Here we have all kinds of shifting identities. In fact, I've written on a note card in front of me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 names that people called themselves in this area. 6 different names that are in your book. So people are identifying with different sorts of groups and different sorts of ethnicities and religions and states and sort of federal territories, and it's just kind of remarkable how many different identities there are in this place. Again, especially for someone who comes from an area which is reasonably homogenous in the United States. So let's begin the story. Let's begin it in 1749. I think it's 1749, and that is the moment at which the rulers of what they called New Spain, which we now call Mexico, I think, decided that they were going to settle the area around the Rio Grande.
Right.
Go ahead and take it from there.
Sure. So the towns along the Rio Grande from Matamoros at the time was called Refugio, but all the way up to Laredo were settled in 1749 by Spanish colonists coming from central New Spain or central Mexico. And they were basically sort of civilian soldier settlers. The colonization of Nuevo Santander, which was what it was called at the time, was carried out in a slightly different way than what was carried out in, say, California or New Mexico. And basically because the Spanish crown had decided that it was too expensive to spend all this money funding missions, the creation of missions, and you know, paying for missionaries and paying for soldiers. So in Nuevo Santander, they were going to sort of combine the two things, and they were going to say, well, these civilians are going to be also soldiers. Among them, they're going to be some soldiers. And they still tried to establish some missions, but in Nuevo Santander, most of the missions were abysmal failures compared to, say, the California missions, or even in other parts of Texas like San Antonio. But in Nuevo Santander, the missions didn't work very well. There was a lot of tension between the missionaries and the civilians. There were some forts as well, but the main thrust was a civilian population, and New Spain was doing this mainly in the mid 18th century as a sort of a defensive measure. They wanted to claim the land, and they wanted to populate it with Spanish colonists, in sort of anticipation of other European powers like the French or the British, or in some areas of the Southwest, Russian forces, Russian colonists coming mm-hmm. in and claiming the land first. And so, New Spain had claimed the land, but they actually hadn't settled it with Spanish colonists. And I should obviously say, for those who might not be familiar, but obviously there was a large Indian population.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. Yeah.
It was very, very much settled. It wasn't, virgin territory. Mm-hmm. But when I say settled, it was settled by Spanish colonists. And these Spanish colonists were quite culturally and ethnically diverse. They weren't all, from Spain. Most of them were born in Mexico. But they had Indian background, European background, as well as African backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of indigenous people there who had been there for long time.
Right. They had been there for a long time, and they were small groups in the South Texas border region near the Gulf, sort of where the Rio Grande empties into the Gulf of Mexico. That's the area that I'm studying, or that's the focus of this book. There was many small groups, not as large a groups as, say, the Comanches or mm-hmm. the Navajos or the Pueblos. They were much smaller, but they interacted with one another, and they were also they had a sort of different kind of lifestyle than, say, other parts of the Southwest. They tended to be hunter gatherers. Their communities tended to be small, and they moved around a lot because they were hunter gatherers. But some of these Indian groups also started interacting with indigenous nations from other parts of Texas that were being pushed down south and west by Anglo-American expansion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very good point, because we tend to think about indigenous history as more or less the Europeans against the indigenous people, but really it was the Europeans against the Europeans, and then the indigenous people against the indigenous people, and all the indigenous people against the Europeans. It was a very complicated picture.
Right, right. And the indigenous people, nations in South Texas, or in the South Texas border region, they were being pushed from both, the South, by, other indigenous people that were being displaced by Spanish encroachment. And then they were being, encroached upon by, from the North, from Texas nations or indigenous nations, mm-hmm. As well. And so there was a lot of tension. There's a lot of interactions. There's a lot of, battles and so forth. And it made for a particularly sort of volatile period where you have certain indigenous nations that are native to the Rio Grande border area, allying sometimes themselves with Spanish colonists to try to fend off sort of larger nations like the Apaches or the Comanches that were much more powerful, much better, or much more adaptable to, you know, using, you know, European weapons, and had acculturated very well mm-hmm. to being horse, equestrian riders and so forth. And, mm-hmm. and so they were very powerful, and they also were very good at sort of playing one European power against another. So they would, for instance, raid Anglo-American settlements in Texas and then trade some of the goods that they had stolen from them with Spanish colonists, and then vice versa. And the they also took, you know, captives, like, you know, so James Brooks, for instance, has written about a book in New Mexico and how both the indigenous nations took captives as well as the Spanish colonists. In Texas, that happened with certain of the larger indigenous nations like the Comanches and Apaches, but it happened less so with the indigenous nations that I study in the border region, because they were smaller and they didn't have the sort of the population, really. But what it did mean was that Spanish colonists did, in many cases, capture indigenous people and use them as slaves. But it didn't happen that much the other way around, at least not with the native groups that were from, you know, along the river. The Comanches and Apaches did take captives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, how did the Spanish imperial authorities, or did the Spanish imperial authorities, were they able to protect these people? Protect is in air quotes.
right. Well, so protect, you mean the indigenous people?
No, I mean the people in the Villa del Norte, if that's what they're called. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, sure. And let me just explain the Villa del Norte. So the person who was responsible for the colonization, who led the colonization of Nuevo Santander, his name is was José de Escandón. He was from Spain, and he was a military officer, and he decided to make the colonization perhaps more efficient by grouping towns, establishing sort of a group of four groups of towns, and the northernmost towns were the Villas del Norte, and mm-hmm. Villas del Norte just means the northern towns mm-hmm. in Nuevo Santander. So they were supposed to provide military protection, the Spanish government, and they tried, but they weren't very effective for various reasons. The main reason is that the distances from, you know, central Mexico, from what today would be Mexico City, to the Villas del Norte were quite large, and it was very hard to send supplies up to that area. It was very hard to pay the soldiers to, you know, keep them equipped. And they also, in a way, it was one of those things where the Spanish government sent the colonists out there, and then they sort of, in many ways, sort of forgot about them in some ways, in the sense that they said, well, they'll take care of themselves. And when the local authorities would request aid, many times those requests were ignored. They just said, you know, we're not gonna supply, you know, the guns, and we're not gonna supply soldiers mm-hmm. or horses or so forth. Sometimes for valid reasons, you know, because the New Spain's government was going through some sort of crisis, but other times because it was sort of a distant, you know, the distant town that they didn't really pay that much attention to. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of been a continuing sort of pattern in that the people of this area have felt neglected by the central government for a very long time. And many times the local politics and the way the residents of the area sort of react to national politics, whether it's national politics in the U.S. or national politics from Mexico, has a lot to do with their feeling of neglect and their feeling of resentment. And all of this started during the colonial period, or some of this started during the colonial period, because the Spanish colonial government failed to protect them. Mm-hmm. And many times, some of that failure was because, you know, like I mentioned, the distance, the lack of communications, but also because sometimes they would appoint sort of, sort of military governors for a while that were not native to the region. And so those military governors, so they were military appointees or political appointees, didn't really have the interest of the region, you know, in mind. They were just interested in their own political careers, and they also wanted to leave as soon as possible. So New Spain's northern frontier from Texas all the way to California and, you know, through New Mexico and Arizona, this was a place that, you know, today we think of it as a place that, that people want to go to because it's warm, it's, you know, it's developed and so forth, right? But in the colonial period, it was a place that was not very appealing to Spanish colonists because it was very far away from most, you know, most areas of settlement. It was very hard to get manufactured goods. There was also the constant threat of Indian attacks, and so it was a place where actually soldiers even who were stationed there wanted to leave. And the cases, the soldiers were when they actually committed any kind of atrocity and they were tried for it, sometimes their punishment was just to return to, you know, California, place like California, because that was considered, you know, the so-called, like, the Siberia of, you know, of New Spain.
Yeah.
Well, people didn't want to be there.
Yeah, well, Siberia was the Siberia of Russia. So, I mean, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, they did the same thing in Russia. Yeah.
Well, the Russian historian, I figured you.
Yeah, they did the same thing. The people who were in this area between roughly 1749 and then the end of the Mexican Revolution, or Mexican War of Mexican Independence, I guess it's called. What did they call themselves? There's a word in your book called vecinos. Is that right?
Vecinos, right.
Yeah, what are those people?
Yeah. Vecinos literally just means neighbors.
Uh-huh.
They call themselves neighbors because it was a way of distinguishing, you know, throughout the Southwest, you know, and in other areas of Mexico, people use this term vecinos, and it mainly meant sort of community members.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were referred to as a vecino, it meant that you had been in that community, whatever community it was, for quite a long time. And so they had names like, you know, when, you know, in political documents, you know, in municipal, you know, court records and so forth, when they would identify you, they would say, you know, here is Juan Garza or so forth. He is a vecino of, and they would mention what town they were from. So a vecino of Camargo or Refugio or Reynosa. And that meant that he had been there for a while and he had longstanding roots there. So it was sort of a way of saying a resident.
Mm-hmm.
And together, the different towns, like the Villas del Norte, they were all seen as vecinos of the Villas del Norte as well.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that my book looks at is sort of political identity and identification of the residents, and they identify, you know, one of the ways I sort of looked at this is by looking at sort of this sort of concentric circle idea of affiliation, a political affiliation that Peter Solon talks about in his book Boundaries, about the Spanish and French Pyrenees area. And, you know, he says that most people identify first, you know, with their town and then with the region and then perhaps maybe with, like, if there's a state or, you know, so forth, and then eventually with the nation.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't completely explain everything, because sometimes some towns identify against another town or against another group of people. So he also talks about sort of oppositional identities. You know, you have an identity as opposed to someone else. So some of the Spanish colonists, for instance, identified as Spanish colonists as opposed to indigenous people,
yeah,
or a Spanish colonist as opposed to European, you know, colonists or Anglo-American colonists. And so the people who lived in this area had various identities, and many of them, you know, just like we do today, there were multiple identities, and some of them seemed today would seem, you know, contradictory, but at the time, it, you know, they didn't seem that contradictory to them. I mean, they had an identity as Christians, and you know, the main religion there was Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't think of themselves as, you know, they thought of themselves as Catholics, and as the indigenous people who were not, hadn't been baptized or hadn't been converted, as, you know, as heathens, you know, as people, they use the term people without reason, gente sin razón,
mm-hmm,
and they considered themselves gente de razón, or people of reason. And the main, you know, dividing, or the main factor is, you know, whether or not you had reason was whether or not you were Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was their view. That wasn't. I'm not saying that's justified, but that
yeah,
was just their,
clearly
that's how
yeah,
they saw themselves.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this is a, you know, a region that undergoes several conquests. You know, first the Spanish arrive and conquer local indigenous nations, and then and they don't necessarily. It's not necessarily a complete conquest, because there are certain nations that they can never conquer, like the Comanches and the Apaches, that do make incursions down into this Rio Grande area. And But, you know, but beginning in basically the 19th century, the early 19th century, they start seeing European Americans arrive, meaning Anglo-Americans arrive. First, you know, as traders, they arrive into the port that's there in Matamoros. There's a very large Anglo-American population that are basically businessmen who establish trading houses with where they trade between Cuba, New Orleans, New York, and Matamoros. And these are supplying sort of the northern towns, you know, from Saltillo to Monterrey to other, you know, major capital cities in northern Mexico today. And then, you know, in the mid-19th century, or even before the mid-19th century, in 1830s, Texas breaks away from Mexico, and there's a lot of tension around that. The area that I studied, the Villas del Norte, weren't completely they didn't become part of Texas in 1836. They were still part of Mexico, but the Texas Revolution, the so-called Texas Revolution, the separatist revolution, did affect the towns. And that the towns, you know, there was a lot of tension. The military, New Spain's military, actually by this time it was Mexico's military, did go through the towns and did abuse the residents along the way. Take supplies, didn't pay for the supplies, and so forth, on their way to San Antonio, on the way to try to, you know, suppress the rebellion in Texas. But anyway, after Texas gains its independence from 1836 to 1845, it was an independent republic. The Villas del Norte remain part of Mexico, and they still remain, sort of reporting to Mexico, and the citizens, the residents there consider themselves Mexican citizens. I actually jumped over a part, which was, you know, Mexico gains its independence in 1821. So part of what happens is these people had been Spanish colonists, and when Mexico gains its independence, they become Mexican citizens. They're Mexican citizens some of them were Mexican citizens for, you know, a little bit over 20 years, from 1821 to 1848. And in 1846, the U.S.-Mexican War breaks out, partly over Texas, but partly over, you know, a boundary dispute in southern Texas. And at the end of the war, the U.S. acquires, you know, a large portion of northern Mexico, including now what today is, the southern Texas area. So some of the people who live in the communities that I study end up becoming U.S. citizens. Some of them remain Mexican citizens because their towns are on the what today would be the Mexican part of the border, and the other towns are on the U.S. side of the border. Some people move because their land is actually on the Texas side of the border, and they start establishing towns all along the river. And so the period from, you know, immediately after 1848 is a period where you have the creation of what we today call twin cities. So the town of Brownsville, for example, which is the southern tip of Texas, was created after the U.S.-Mexican War, right opposite of Matamoros, which was the one of the Villas del Norte. Same thing happens in Reynosa. Another town gets created a lot across the river. At the time, it was called Hidalgo. It's still called Hidalgo, but another major city there is McAllen. And Laredo gets created. Nuevo Laredo gets created, so it's New Laredo, and that's on the Mexican side, because Laredo is one of the few towns that is actually an old Villas del Norte that ends up on the Texas side. But anyway, and as a result of the U.S.-Mexican War, the U.S. takes over this area and starts establishing municipal governments all along, just like they do, you know, throughout New Mexico and California and so forth. And so you have a change in jurisdiction, and you have a change of laws. The community, as I mentioned before, is, you know, predominantly Mexican, so they become Mexican Americans, which means that they're ethnically Mexican, but they're now American citizens, and they're part of the population in the Southwest that, today, Mexican American activists, Latino activists say, these people didn't cross the border crossed them. That line comes from that particular, you know, event. Yeah. That, you know, there's communities in California and New Mexico and Arizona and so forth where there's people alive today whose ancestors you know, basically didn't cross an international border, right? They were living in with then New Spain, then they were living in Mexico, and then all of a sudden they became part of the U.S. as a result of a war of conquest, as a result of the U.S.-Mexican War. So they didn't come to the U.S. The U.S. came to them, and that's where that line comes from. But as a result of this change in jurisdiction, now all of a sudden you have different laws. You have U.S. laws. You have a different language. You know, English being spoken more widely. Although in Texas, all the laws had to be translated into Spanish, at least in the 19th century, because they wanted to make sure the population understood what was going on and understood the laws. But as a result of this change in jurisdiction, you also have changes. One of the things that I found in researching my book that I thought was fascinating is, the period after 1848 has been seen as a period of, has been described in the past in the first sort of books on Mexican Americans, that came out in the 60s and 70s as a period of declension, meaning that basically Mexican Americans throughout the Southwest lost power. They lost political power. They lost economic power. They lost social power. They started losing their land. They started losing, being seen as sort of criminals, as the people who are sort of the lower class. And Anglo-Americans in general ended up sort of supplanting them, being the mayors, being the governors, and so forth. But one of the things I found, and that did happen in South Texas, it happened more gradually in some counties than in others, in some areas than in others, and it basically had to do with how fast this transition happened, how fast Mexican Americans were displaced, had to do with whether that county or the city or whatever city we're talking about, how quickly that became a trade center. If it became a trade center, then it attracted Anglo-Americans in great numbers, and therefore, like for instance, Brownsville, Cameron County, it's in Cameron County. They take over, Anglo-Americans take over Cameron County pretty quickly because Brownsville is a major trading center. In neighboring Hidalgo County next door, it takes a little longer. And so Mexican-Americans are able to maintain power and maintain their land a little longer, into the late 19th century. And other historians have written about that. Same thing happens in California. In L.A., they get displaced pretty quickly. In Santa Barbara, it takes a little longer. It takes a little longer to get displaced. But anyway, one of the things I found out that I had not anticipated when I started my research was that the changing laws also affected women in ways that were unexpected for me, at least. So in Spain and in New Spain and then in Mexico, the Catholic Church governed marriage, and it also governed divorce. And what it basically meant that marriage, you could only get married if you were Catholic, and you had to get married through the church. And you really couldn't get divorced, not the way that we know about it today. Mm-hmm. You could not have an absolute divorce. You could have these things called temporary divorces, which would just allow you to a couple to separate for a few, till you worked out your differences. And then there were these sort of more permanent divorces, and that just allowed the couple to live independently, but they were still technically married, because according to Catholic Church, once you're married, you're always married in the eyes of God until one of the spouses died, and then only then could the surviving spouse remarry. But if you even if you got a permanent divorce, which are very, very hard to get, you could not remarry until your spouse passed away. What happens in when the U.S. takes over, the southern part of Texas, is at least for the communities that I study, right? You have people who all of a sudden become U.S. citizens, and their friends and family members that live on the other side. So, for instance, people who are living in Brownsville now and who own land there, they become U.S. citizens all of a sudden. In 1849, they're U.S. citizens. Their friends and family members in Matamoros are Mexican citizens. Well, as U.S. citizens, now they can get divorced, because in the 19th century, most Western states, and it varied across the U.S., but most Western states allowed divorce relatively easily. And there's a long, complicated reason for that, but part of it had to do with they wanted to attract settlers. And one way to attract settlers is to make divorce easier to obtain.
Wow.
They also had very easy sort of residency requirements because they wanted people to be able to move there and vote. So it was, you know, it was a different kind of thing. The strictest divorce laws were in the South. And in the Northeast, there was also generally pretty good, pretty easy divorce, or relatively easy divorce. But the most sort of the laxest divorce, you know, rules were in the West. So the West had very high number of divorces, divorce rates. Texas was one of those Western states, and so you actually had in Texas, and in other parts of the West, this phenomenon, this pattern where people would move to Texas just to get a divorce because you could become a resident within 3 months, and then you could get a divorce. And you could get a divorce for a variety of reasons, very easy reasons. So for one of them, you could get the most common kind of divorce you could get, or the most common reason you could give for getting a divorce was abandonment, meaning you just, you know, your spouse had abandoned you, had left. So women whose husbands left and never returned could file for divorce. They had to wait for a period of 3 years after the spouse left, but then they could get a divorce. And it was pretty easy to obtain because basically they published the divorce notice in the newspaper, mm-hmm. and they allowed a certain amount of time, like a month or 2 months, to pass by. And then they had a hearing, and if the husband didn't show up, which usually they didn't, if they had abandoned their wives, then they got a divorce. And that meant that they could reclaim any kind of property that they had, and it also meant that they could reclaim their maiden name if they wanted to. And more importantly, it meant, for the West at least, it meant that they could remarry. And it was really important for them to remarry because it's very hard. You know, I mean, it's very hard today to live as a single parent. It was much harder, you know, in the 19th century West. So they could remarry. So Mexican Americans actually took part in this. They were able to obtain divorces. They could obtain divorces because in the 19th century, the divorce in the U.S. was no longer a religious matter. It was a civil matter. So civil authorities granted divorces, civil judges. So you could also marry through, the civil authorities as well. So even if you were Catholic, you know, most Mexican Americans in the 19th century were Catholic, they might not be able to marry. Well, they definitely couldn't marry through the Catholic Church or remarry through the Catholic Church once they got a divorce. But it didn't matter because they could get married through a judge, through a civil authority. So if they got a divorce, they could go to a judge and remarry. And many of them remarried and then continued attending the church, and it didn't matter. And they would actually baptize their children and so forth. The priest just couldn't remarry them in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened is that Protestant churches also arrived, and they could marry through a Protestant church. Certain Protestant churches allowed divorced people to remarry. But anyway, that was actually something that I thought was really interesting because it was actually, in a way, you could see it as an opportunity for women, and it was mainly women who were taking part of in the divorce laws, because men were the ones, at least in the 19th century, who were many times abandoning them. You could also get divorced if you accused your spouse of adultery, if you could accuse your spouse of being emotionally or physically abusive. Of not supporting, the family and so forth. But as I mentioned, the most common one was abandonment. One way to look at this, one way of interpreting this kind of change is that women and men, but mainly women, were able to escape the power, you could say, of the Catholic Church, escape the power of, what we today would call a patriarchal institution that was governed by men but had a lot of power over women and who didn't really allow women this freedom to leave abusive or non-supportive husbands. Mm-hmm. Or to just get their property back because, sometimes the husbands had left them and they were living on their own anyway, they were living with their family, but they couldn't make certain decisions. They couldn't get their property back. Their husbands still sort of legally controlled them. And in Mexico, actually, their husbands could legally force them to move with them, and authorities would arrest them and actually, take their wives and, move their wives wherever their husbands wanted to be. This all basically disappeared. They didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. So in a way, one of the things, getting back to my book, one of the things that happens is the change in jurisdiction that occurs, after the U.S.-Mexican War allows women more opportunities. And this is something that sort of goes against this idea that the post U.S.-Mexican War period is a period of declension. Because for women, it is, in a way, you know, because they're still, if they're part of landed families, they also lose power, they lose money, they lose land, but they gain some opportunities. And one of the opportunities is more sort of personal freedom in their marital choices.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in a way, it's such an irony. I know you may have heard of the concept of a Mexican divorce. It was in the 1960s. People would go to Mexico and get divorced because they had very lax divorce laws.
Right.
Yeah, so this is the opposite of this is a Texan divorce.
Right, well, sort of, yeah. And I mean, the laws in Mexico about divorce didn't change until the 20th century.
Yeah, that's right.
In the 19th century, it was still very much governed by the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I have a few quick questions. One of them involves the word, and I've heard this word a lot, you know, just sort of it flashes by my ear. I don't know if that's a mixed metaphor, but Tejanos. Well, in this era, what does that mean and who is that?
Okay. So Tejano today means someone who's of Mexican background or Mexican-American background but who lives in Texas.
Okay.
So in the 19th century, or, you know, even today, people refer to, say, Californios, meaning in the 19th century it was Mexican-Americans from California, Nuevo Mexicanos, or people from New Mexico who are of Mexican-American background, or initially Mexican background, but eventually Mexican-American once they became U.S. citizens. Same thing happened in Texas. So Anglo-Texans, you know, the term that historians use is Anglo-Texans, meaning, and it's a misnomer because, you know, many people that we refer to as Anglo-Texans weren't Anglo at all. You know, they were just European Americans, but, you know, they might have been Jewish or they might have been, you know.
Germans, a lot of Germans, yeah.
Germans, right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But in Texas history, they all sort of fall under Anglo-Texans. But anyway, so Anglo-Texans, are, you know, one group of people, or historians sort of group them together, even though they're not really one group. They're many grouped. For Mexican Americans living in Texas, they call them Tejanos, or Texas Mexicans is another term they used. And it's a way to distinguish them, you know, to sort of indicate their ethnic identity as well as sort of, you know, where they live. So today we talk about, you know, Italian Americans, you know, right, Japanese Americans, so whatever, Mexican Americans. Back then, they were also saying, sort of more specifically, people who are Mexicans living in Texas are Tejanos.
Mm-hmm. But they're American citizens.
They're American citizens, exactly.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I have a couple of other quick questions. Go ahead.
Sure. Oh, no, and I was going to say, and that identity didn't come really, it didn't happen immediately. You know, for the people that I study, it didn't happen when Texas became a republic, and it didn't happen until much later in the 19th century, where they started sort of identifying, again, sort of as an oppositional identity. They weren't Anglo-Texans. They weren't Mexican citizens anymore. So they started realizing, oh, we're sort of, you know, we're Texas Mexicans, we're Tejanos, because we're part of the U.S., we're living in Texas, and some of the laws that apply to us, some of the things that apply to us do not apply to our friends and relatives living in Mexico.
That's interesting. So as I say, I have a couple of kind of miscellaneous questions that occurred to me while I was reading the book. One of them involves slavery, and that is, I know slavery was practiced in New Spain. Were there still slaves when the Mexicans who were sort of caught across the border when the United States took that big chunk, did they still have slaves, and what happened to them?
Sure. Okay. And you're referring to the enslavement of African people, right?
Well, it could be enslavement of anybody, because I know they enslaved Indians as well, right?
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So I'll mention the enslavement of African people because that's the one that we think about the most.
Okay.
So Mexico had outlawed slavery, but it allowed slavery in certain areas. They had outlawed slavery when Mexico became an independent nation in the 1820s. But in Texas, in order to attract Europeans to colonize Texas, there was this sort of colonization effort to attract both European Americans as well as Americans, Anglo-Americans, to Texas. They allowed slavery because many of the people moving to Texas were from the South.
Uh-huh.
So they allowed slavery, enslavement of Africans. And so people moved to Texas, people moved to San Antonio, to Austin from the South, and they brought their slaves with them. So when Texas became independent, they allowed slavery. And when Texas became part of the U.S., you know, it was a slave state.
Mm-hmm.
In the border region that I studied, the enslavement of African Americans wasn't really practiced that much, partly because once the U.S.-Mexico border, once the Rio Grande becomes the border between the U.S. and Mexico, it was really easy for slaves, or African slaves, to flee into Mexico, uh-huh. and obtain their freedom.
Oh, I see.
So there were still some slaves in San Antonio, for example, but the slavery, large-scale slavery occurred more in sort of the northern parts of Texas, like in Houston and, you know, above Austin and Dallas and so forth. In East Texas, I would say. Less so along the border. There was a few European Americans who moved to the border region and brought their slaves with them, but their slaves wouldn't be there 10 years later.
Mm-hmm. We see.
They would have left.
Was it legal to enslave the indigenous Americans, if we can call them that?
No, it mm-hmm. wasn't legal, but it happened.
Yeah.
And sort of authorities, municipal authorities, would just look the other way. So it happened a lot. And one of the things that I write about in the first chapter of my book is the way that indigenous people of the region basically became part of Spanish society. And one way is that they were captured as babies. You know, they were taken from their families, and they were raised in Spanish households, to be basically servants.
Right.
They called them criados, or people who were raised. These indigenous workers became domestic servants, or they became ranch hands, or they became, eventually they would obtain their freedom as adults. But when they were young, they were basically, slaves.
Mm-hmm. So another question I had was involved, and the next two questions really involve the degree to which the two ethnic communities, that is, Mexican-Americans and Anglos, interacted. And one involves marriage. I have to assume that most of the Anglos who were there were Protestants, and almost all of the Mexicans were Catholic. Did they intermarry, and could they intermarry, and how did they negotiate this?
Right, they intermarried. So as I mentioned, once the area becomes part of the U.S., they could intermarry by basically going to a Protestant church that allowed mixed marriages. Interfaith marriages. In some cases, a spouse would convert. So they would convert they would become a Catholic, or they would become a Protestant.
Uh-huh.
But in other cases, if their church didn't allow it, then they could just go get married through civil authorities. Mm-hmm. They could just have a civil wedding. And usually this kind of marriage occurred only among the elite. Anglo-Americans who would arrive in Texas would often marry sort of wealthy or landed into landed families. So the daughters of sort of a large ranch owner would get married. And that was one of the ways that they obtained property, because it was, most property was already sort of allocated in a way. And so one way to do that was to intermarry with the Mexican-American woman. But it was also a way for, people in business, if it was an Anglo-American who was, a merchant, to establish, basically extensive social ties. Because once he married into a Mexican family, he had all these Mexican relatives and all these, not just relatives, mm-hmm. but also just connections. And so his business would thrive if, they knew that he was married into, to the Garzas or to the Baez or so forth. Mm-hmm. These are surnames that are very common in South Texas.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So then another question about the two groups and the degree to which they interacted. I don't know which to say. Were the Anglos ghettoized, or were the Mexican-Americans ghettoized? Did they live in similar confines, or were they?
Well, I mean, I think you. That's a hard question to translate, but I would say that what you have is a period in the second half of the 19th century where, because the laws have changed, you have this process that, scholars refer to as criminalization of certain kinds of cultural activities that Mexicans had been participating in for years, and all of a sudden, because there's new laws being enacted, some of their activities are now criminal. One of the things, for example, that they couldn't do necessarily anymore is play certain kinds of card games. There was a card game called Monte that was considered illegal. Certain kinds of dances that took place mainly among working class were outlawed. Mexican Americans were still participating in it, but they were sort of participating in it sort of, illegally. They were doing it, but authorities could crack down on them. Another thing that was just sort of, restricted, I shouldn't say completely illegal, was bathing in the rivers. They would, Mexicans would bathe in the rivers, especially the working class. After the U.S. takes over, this activity is restricted, and in some cases, restricted to certain hours or certain parts of the river only. But in terms of ghettoize, in terms of like segregation and, sort of housing segregation, I don't think you're going to see that right away. You're obviously going to see, wealthy families having sort of multiple homes. They have a ranch home, for example, and then they have a home in the city, in a nearby city. And their homes are probably going to be in certain areas of the city as opposed to sort of more working class areas. But it didn't mean that there was actually laws barring sort of Mexican Americans from living in certain areas. That doesn't happen until much later.
Yeah, redlining is, yeah, sort of a later thing.
Right.
Yeah. Just as an aside, and I don't know if you can answer this, can you still see the echo of these elite Mexican American families in this area today? Are there famous names that can be?
Oh, sure.
Like,
sure.
Oh, these guys, you know, they're like, you know, famous.
Yeah. So one of the ones that I use in my classes, one of the most famous examples is, so during spring break, a lot of students go down to Texas to South Padre Island.
Yeah.
Well, South Padre Island is named after Father Bailly, and it's called Father Island because it was given to him. he was a Spanish colonist. He
Everybody
was a priest, and his nephews and nieces, right? Because he didn't have children, but the descendants of his brothers and sisters have actually filed litigation to try to reclaim the island many years ago, and some of they were sort of partially successful actually in a way, because they did prove that the land was his initially, and that it had been sort of taken under less than legal circumstances. But anyway, when you go from Brownsville to South Padre Island, you go over this big bridge in South Texas, the South Padre Island area, and there's actually a statue right at the beginning or at the end of the bridge for Father Bailly. So he's one of the famous names. So Bailly is a very common name. The Hinojosas are very common, landed families, De La Garzas. There's a whole slew of them. But it doesn't mean that all their descendants are still sort of landed people. Many of them are now working class, and they've lost their property and so forth.
Yeah, I just find it interesting that these families are probably, they probably are more Texan than the Texans are now. They probably, that they've been completely, they've been sort of completely, assimilated and more.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, you have, for instance, in South Texas, when I was growing up and even today, many of the Mexican American youth are, very much integrated into sort of the high school sports scene. They're football players.
I was going to ask about that football.
Cheerleaders and so forth. Oh, yeah. And, and that's much more popular. When I was growing up, it's much more popular than soccer.
Yeah.
Now there's more soccer. There's more, activity around soccer. But it also has to do with recent immigrants. So most of the people who are, many of the students who are participating in soccer are going to be recent immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of the older Mexican American families are still going to be very much attracted to the American football.
Yeah, and that's another thing I wanted to ask about. And this is something that when I was growing up, I said Kansas is usually homogenous. It's not entirely, but when I was growing up, we would go to areas of Kansas that had old Mexican populations, and these guys. And women, of course, they had cowboy hats on and cowboy boots, and just their name was Hidalgo, and that was the only difference.
Right.
As far as I could tell, they were Kansans.
Well, they had been there since they probably started living in these communities, or at least their ancestors in the 19th century as a result of cattle drives from Texas.
And I wondered how in this area, this borderland area, how those sort of really assimilated Mexican Americans, how they relate to newer immigrants. Let's put it that way.
Oh. Sure, that's a good question. One of the things that several historians have found, probably the best example of this is in a book called Walls and Mirrors by David Gutierrez, is that there's a lot of, he explains in this book why there's tension between Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants. There's tension because Mexican Americans consider themselves U.S. citizens. They've lived in the U.S. for quite a long time. Some of them don't even speak Spanish anymore. And when Mexican immigrants arrive, there's, in some cases, especially among the working class, there's competition, and there's been competition over jobs, over housing, and so forth. But more importantly, over the years, let's say in the early 20th century, for example, there were certain civil rights organizations, the Mexican-American civil rights organizations, like the most prominent one being the League of Latin American, of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, that actually took a stand to exclude Mexican immigrants from their organization. which today they don't do that anymore.
Yeah,
they actually threw them out. At their founding Congress, they threw them out. They threw out the Mexican immigrants, and they said, we don't want you in our organization. Because basically, they saw, LULAC members and Mexican Americans saw Mexican immigrants as giving them a bad name, as, you know, being the people who are, you know, poor, because they're recent immigrants, who didn't speak Spanish, who had sort of more Mexican traditions than American traditions. And for Mexican Americans who wanted to fit in the early 20th century, or even today, you know, those who were just recently arrived were seen, you know, as the sort of the norm. And so for people who aren't Mexican American, it's very hard for, say, someone who's of Italian American background or, you know, whatever European American background, to be able to tell the difference between a Mexican American and a Mexican immigrant. You definitely can't tell, you know, many times just when they speak or whatever. It's other little subtleties that you know where you can sort of tell. And so because of that, you know, the sort of non-Mexican community would think of all of them as recent Mexican immigrants. And, you know, LULAC members in the early 20th century, and today even Mexican Americans see, want to distance themselves in some cases from recent immigrants because they don't want to be sort of grouped together with them. Because in some cases they're poor, they don't speak English as well, and so forth. Whatever sort of negative characteristic they, you know, Mexican Americans might ascribe to them. But it's the same thing among other immigrants. So,
yeah.
You know, when I taught in California, in Southern California, you know, Chinese immigrants or Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, they had, you know, sort of, you know, very negative terms to that they used to refer to recent Chinese immigrants, because they didn't want to be associated with them for the same reason. They want to see themselves as Chinese Americans, and many of them have been in California for, you know, many generations, right, since the 19th century, and they have very little in common besides sort of their ethnic background with recent Chinese immigrants, because many of the Chinese Americans, you know, aren't going to speak Chinese anymore, just like Mexican Americans don't. Many of them don't speak Spanish anymore.
I just find all that fascinating, because, you know, you want to say, like, they, and I know about this in the Korean community and the Russian community, the same thing, and they do have what I would call, you can't really call it an ethnic slur, because they're both of the same ethnicity, but they have these names for them that are not terribly polite.
No, and it's very vicious, and, you know, and I mean, and it has to do with, I mean, and for Mexican Americans and for other communities, it also has to do with voting rights also, right? Because in some cases, like in the 19th century, there were certain counties where, you know, along the border, where a losing if a politician lost an election, they would blame it on Mexican immigrants who had voted illegally. And they, when they made these statements, they would sort of accuse the entire Mexican community of being illegal voters. So it really put Mexican Americans in a very sort of, you know, difficult situation, because they thought, well, we're Mexican Americans, we're citizens, we want to vote, and yet these politicians are accusing us of not being voters, of not being, you know, legal voters. In the 19th century, there was also tension between Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants over cattle theft. There was a lot of, you know, theft. I mean, cattle was very prized in the 19th century in Texas. And because of the communities along the border, it was very easy to steal on one side of the border, whether in Mexico or the U.S., and then take the cattle over to the other side and sell it. Well, Mexican immigrants, in some cases, or just Mexican nationals, I should say, were crossing the border, stealing, and then going back into Mexico. And so there was tension between Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants over that. There was tensions over, you know, different conflicts. So, for instance, during the Civil War, Texas, since it was a slave state, had a Confederate draft. So there's actually many Mexican Americans who served in the Confederate Army, but there was also Mexican Americans who served in the Union Army and established Union Army troops in South Texas. And the Union actually recruited, both the Confederacy and the Union recruited on both sides of the border. And even though in the 19th century, you know, the citizenship of Mexican Americans was questioned, you know, before the Civil War and after the Civil War, during the Civil War, military recruiters didn't care. They were like, you know, we don't care whether you're Mexican American, Mexican national. If you want to fight in our, you know, on our side, we'll take you.
Yeah.
So they recruited on both sides.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really thank you for it. It's a fascinating book. Today we've been talking to Omar Valerio Jimenez about his book, River of Hope, Forging Identity and Nation in the Rio Grande Borderlands. So, Omar, let me ask our traditional final question before we close the interview on New Books, on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Sure. So my next book is called Remembering Conquest, and it's about U.S.-Mexican War. It's about history and memory of the U.S.-Mexican War and how Mexican-American activists, Chicano activists, have used the memory of the U.S.-Mexican War as a sort of motivation for civil rights struggles throughout the beginning of the 19th century, but also into the 20th century. How it's remembered, how it's sort of used as a sort of a motivating organizing tool, and how basically people remember a war that they didn't actually experience, obviously, but their community experience. And how do they remember the promises that, you know, of the treaty that ended the war, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, to press for their civil rights?
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds fascinating, and I hope you'll come back on the show when you're done with it.
I would be happy.
Okay, good.
Thanks for this opportunity.
All right. Take care, Omar.
Okay, bye.